Session on Senate Bill 41.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move the Dash One Amendment to Senate Bill 41.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash One Amendments to Senate Bill 41. Discussion? Seeing no discussion, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Mons Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. Amendment has been approved.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 41 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
41 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing no discussion, would you call the roll, please?
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Mons Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. Senate Bill 41, having received the constitutional requirements, we'll go to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation, and I would ask Senator Berger to carry the bill.
On behalf of
the Senate. Okay, thank you very much. We will open up. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 157. James, would you come forward, please? Anyone else that you would like to bring up, please? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Taves from the Oregon Department of Human Services, and maybe I'll just let each of the panel members introduce themselves.
I'm Cheryl Sanders. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Home Care Commission.
And my name is Carla Spence, and I am the coordinator for SEIU Local 503's Home Care Division.
That's a great combination.
Great.
James, would you like to?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senate Bill 157, introduced by the department at the request of the governor, is really a technical change, but it's a bit complex and has a long history. So I'll try to summarize briefly and succinctly the issues in this bill and what got us to this point. And I think you have in front of you a complete rewrite of the bill in its current form that has already been sent to Legislative Council. And it's really that draft that we're working off of, and I will explain the sections of that bill and the reasons for it. In 1999, Measure 99 passed, the constitutional ballot measure, which created the Home Care Commission in the Oregon Constitution, which had several purposes. One, to improve in-home services for seniors and people with disabilities in the state of Oregon, to begin to set more detailed training standards and quality of care standards, but more importantly, to allow as a vehicle the home care workers of the state to collectively organize themselves and ultimately be represented as they are now by SEIU. In the Constitution, the Home Care Commission is the employer of record for purposes of collective bargaining. So that is the vehicle in the Constitution that created this vehicle that allowed these workers to organize themselves. We have approximately about 12,000 home care workers in the state of Oregon. It's a program that actually sort of leads the country in the number of seniors and people with disabilities that we support in their own homes. Under the program historically, even before it went under the umbrella of the Home Care Commission, clients could hire their own workers, including family members. The state would then set the rate and pay for hours of care depending on that person's care needs and plan. So the program has a long history, and actually about 40% of all seniors and people with disabilities that we serve in long-term care in Oregon is under the home care program. So it's quite a notable program and has sort of nationwide recognition. when the Home Care Commission was created by the Constitution, and then the 2001 session did the enabling legislation. In the Constitution itself, it says no employees of the Home Care Commission are employees of the state of Oregon, and the only role is for that commission to be the employer of record for collective bargaining purposes, but they are not state employees under any circumstances. And that was spelled out in the Constitution. And clearly the intent, we all agree, was to target the actual home care workers who work for clients in our communities. What we didn't think through at the time was what would happen to the actual employees of the commission that would administer the program, set the standards, and do all the collective bargaining kinds of activities. And they were caught under that same constitutional language, which set off a whole series of problems that we've been struggling with for 4 years, with literally hundreds of hours of meetings with attorneys from the department, DAS, the Attorney General's office, trying to figure out how this sort of unique creation really fits inside state government. Because typically, when you set up semi-independent commissions, and we have lots of them in Oregon, their employees are state employees. So they're represented by the Attorney General's office. Many of them with small budgets are supported by DAS shared services, so they don't have to do their own accounting, budgeting, personnel, all of those kinds of things. But this particular creation, since it said they could not be state employees, and that translated also to the commission's employees, put them in that same category of, or put them outside the category of your typical semi-independent commissions. And so we've had endless questions on whether DAS can support them, whether the Attorney General's office can really support them, and it really has gone round and round. Furthermore, to get the ball rolling, what the Department of Human Services did is we simply jump-started this commission. The governor appointed the commissioners, they were confirmed by the Senate, and then we simply double-filled employee positions within the department to initially get this staffed. To this day, the employees of the commission are still double-filled employees of the department because we have not found a resolution to this issue. The original bill that we brought forward would have completely spun the commission off independently with its own staff, its own agency number. But as we worked both with the legislative council, with legislative fiscal office, with DAS and everyone else, they said, however, since the employees of the commission itself are still non-state employees, that means they'll have to go off, hire their own attorney, set up their own accounting, doing their own banking, and it literally, they were described as being sort of like SAFE or OHSU. So we went round and round. Finally, and we don't have the budget to set them up as a completely independent agency doing all those functions themselves. So what we finally arrived at through many, many hours of negotiations is that in the bill itself, we will essentially strip out of the statute any mention of the commission having its own staff. We will continue the relationship where the department has the employees that actually staff the commission. The commission itself will enter into an interagency agreement with the department. We will provide full staffing support, budget, accounting, all of those kind of functions. The AG will still provide legal advice. DAS will still provide support. And in the statute and in an interagency agreement that we would strike, if assuming the bill passes, we would then spell out, even though they're department employees, they are fully dedicated to the policy purposes of the commission, that the department would not be able to interfere with that. And in fact, the executive director, Cheryl, who will speak in a moment, who currently serves as the director of the commission, the department would appoint her with the commission support. And so the commission would have a veto authority over its staffing. So it's sort of a complicated arrangement, but based on all the legal issues, we think it finally is a fit that allows the commission to do its policy work, to be independent, clearly as was envisioned in the constitutional measure, but all the staff and support and legal and budget functions can continue to be supported as they have been. The draft that you have in front of you that we have sent to Legislative Council from the Attorney General's office essentially, we believe, accomplishes those functions. So at a high level, that's what this bill attempts to do.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? No questions. Cheryl? Oh, I'm sorry.
Hi.
I do have written testimony.
Introduce yourself.
Okay. To Mr. Chair Morissette and the members of the committee, I am Cheryl Sanders, the Executive Director of the Oregon Home Care Commission. I have written testimony that we can provide you also with. I am testifying in support of Senate Bill.
Oh, why, give it to the lady over there. Yeah.
This is our first experience, so you have to bear
with
us.
Thank you.
I am testifying today in support of Senate Bill 157 with amendments for several reasons. And James has so clearly stated many of those same reasons that we are in support of Senate Bill 157. And the first area I'd like to talk about is employees of the Home Care Commission will become DHS employees. This is critical because, as James has already spoken, we have ran into many difficulties in trying to just basically do our daily work. And we will be able to carry out all of that according to statute and constitutional duties, functions, and mission of the Home Care Commission if Senate Bill 157 passes. It also allows the Home Care Commissioners themselves to continue to have prior approval of who is appointed as the Executive Director, and we hope also in cases where the Executive Director would have to be removed that they'd also be involved. Secondly, Senate Bill 157 with amendments creates a structure that will be reflected in statute and administrative rule for the daily operational duties and functions of the Home Care Commission. In the past, when we needed to have a contract signed, find out if an agreement needed to be signed, who would do a particular task or was responsible for it, we'd have to go through lengthy conversations, emails, talk to attorneys. Legal fees were assessed just to get the answer to do that. Senate Bill 157 will resolve that issue, and we will not have to continue to do that. And it will also allow us to work cooperatively, as we have been, with SPD and develop an interagency agreement that will further detail things like department expenditures, staff support, and other functions. SB 157 also allows us to look to the future. There are some things that we're doing with training, for example. And we train home care workers, and then we're in the process of training also consumers of services. And during our home care worker trainings, often we have people who are not home care workers who provide services in a different environment, like adult foster home providers. This amendment will allow us to prescribe and charge fees for those private pay providers or non-home care workers when they attend trainings. And this would just cover things like our material costs and administrative costs for that. This will only enhance the ability of all Oregonians to have access to trained private pay providers and home care workers paid with public funds. In addition, we will be reworking Section 3, Lines 7 and 8, and Page 11, Lines 15 and 16, with some further amendments that have to do about the criminal record checks. What the Home Care Commission is really interested in is any individual who wants to be referred out on our referral registry that I'll talk about a little bit later. And if they are a private pay provider, we want to be able to perform criminal record checks on those individuals before they could be referred out on the registry. And again, this will only enhance the ability of Oregonians to have access to individuals who work in their homes and have a feeling that they've been at least checked through that process. And finally, Senate Bill 157 with amendments will allow the Home Care Commission to carry out its mission. In 2000, the people of Oregon spoke by passing ballot measure 99. And the commission's mission is to define the qualifications of home care workers, to create a statewide registry for home care workers, to provide training opportunities for home care workers and consumers, and to serve as an employer of record for collective bargaining purposes. If you look also at the Senate bill on page 1, lines 22 and 24, what that actually does is directs the Director of the Human Services to instruct the employees of the commission to continue to support the statutory and constitutional functions and duties of the commission. And we feel that's extremely important. And as a commission, we know that we have that mission to follow, and we do not at any time want to stray from that mission. I would like to also highlight some of the things that the commission has done to meet that mission. One, we have developed standard statewide home care worker qualifications. We have both basic and career qualifications. Basic would be for individuals who just provide care or services for their family members, and then career would be for those who want to provide services for the general public. We have developed a training program for home care workers. Currently, we have about 30 to 40 trainings per month, and in the startup year, we've trained over 1,200 home care workers. The Home Care Commission is in the final stages of developing a statewide internet-based registry. This registry will allow consumers, employers, their representatives, SPD, AAA local office staff with access to qualified home care workers 24 hours a day. Home care workers will be able to go into the system and update their availability, when they want to work, and the type of services they will provide. We have also partnered with the State Independent Living Council to provide training for consumers of in-home services. We have established a Home Care Commission SPD work group that to ensure consistency and apply procedures. And as a result of that committee, we now have a Home Care Worker Procedure Manual, which is an online tool available for all local office staff to utilize. In 2005, we partnered with the Department of Human Services, SAFE Corporation, SEIU, Labor Oregon, LURC, to develop and publish safety manuals for home care workers and for consumers. Those are just some of the things that we're involved in and continue to do and want the opportunity to continue to do that, and believe that Senate Bill 157 will allow us to do that. And that is a means of providing services that for consumers in the state of Oregon with trained home care workers, with people who have been criminally record checked also. Mm-hmm. I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you in support of SB 157 and its amendments. Do you have any questions?
Thank you, Cheryl. Questions? Have you been with the commission since its inception?
No, sir. I started in May of 2006.
Oh, okay. Okay, good.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
How many staff does this entail?
We have a training manager and a registry manager, and each of those individuals have a support staff member, and then myself and one administrative staff person.
So this bill is for six people?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Good afternoon, Senator Morissette and members of the committee. My name is Carla Spence, and I, too, speak in favor of Senate Bill 157, although I want to share with you a couple of concerns that we're still trying to work through in terms of the appointment of the executive director of the Home Care Commission. Currently, the commissioners themselves, and there are five consumer employer commissions on the Home Care Commission, and that was by design to allow consumers to have a majority vote on the Home Care Commission. And then there are representatives from the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities, the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, the Oregon Disability Commission, and then also the Area Agencies on Aging and Disability. So we have all the major stakeholders who also have a voice on the commission. The commissioners are appointed by the governor and approved by the Senate. In the past, we have had, before Cheryl, we have had two other executive directors of the Home Care Commission. One was sort of an interim person, and then Sharon Miller, who is a longtime DHS SPD employee who came in and worked for the commission on a fairly short-term basis, and then Cheryl. Cheryl came through a process where the home care commissioners, the governor's office, our organization, and other stakeholders had some role in vetting her, if you will, and we were all very pleased and happy when she came on board, and quite frankly, I can tell you that a lot of the accomplishments that have been made over the last 6 years, most of them were, and the stage was set before that, but the last 2 years we've really had a lot of progress with the Home Care Commission in terms of fulfilling their responsibilities. The concern that I raise is that under Senate Bill 157, the Department of Human Services Director would appoint the Executive Director of the Home Care Commission. And I'm not concerned with the current cast of characters at all, but I think that policy should be set based on a balance that goes beyond the current characters, or cast of characters, if you will. And I'm concerned, I would personally like to see that the governor continue to appoint the executive director in consultation with the home care commissioners and with other stakeholders, and that the executive director also be confirmed by the Senate, just as a way to separate that the Home Care Commission is not a function of DHS. It really is something, an entity that needs to be independent of Department of Human Services. For the most part, we have had, and I speak, the Home Care Commission, DHS, and in most cases, SEIU, have been on the same page in terms of the initiatives that we have worked forward on within the Home Care Commission. But there may come a time that that might not be the case, and I would like to be able to say that the executive director of the Home Care Commission is primarily following the statute and the constitutional authority that she or he has, rather than working as an employee of the Department of Human Services. I checked the Constitution, Oregon's Constitution, this morning. There's only one other commission that is established constitutionally, and that's the Oregon Lottery Commission. And their executive director is appointed by the governor and is confirmed by the Senate. That's one of the concerns that I have about this. And we've had many conversations. We're trying to get on the same page with this, but I did want to raise that as a potential problem. Cheryl mentioned a couple of other places where there were, I wanted to also mentioned when Cheryl talked about the statewide training program, I just want to have a chance to crow a little bit here. When the training program that we have developed came about as a result of the collective bargaining process, we were able to secure funding through the collective bargaining process and approved by the legislature to actually fund that training program. The same is true with the registry operation. The startup costs for that registry also were borne out of the funds that were set aside for the collective bargaining agreement. The qualifications that Cheryl mentioned, we've established new qualifications for home care workers where home care workers themselves were involved in setting those standards in committee and fully supported raising the level of professionalism in the home care field. We're really proud of that. The other thing that we, in terms of improving wages and benefits, as you probably know, home care workers now enjoy health insurance, workers' compensation, paid time off for the first time ever, and that has also created a workforce that is more stable and is able to provide a better quality of services to our seniors and people with disabilities. And I just had to say that here today. And on behalf of home care workers around the state, I would like to thank publicly all of the partners that made that happen, including the legislature. We do have concerns about sections 3 and 4 of the amendments. The language in the amendments leads us, the way it's written right now, it sounds like it would transfer the function of the criminal background checks that are currently being done on home care, prospective and ongoing home care workers, from the Department of Human Services to the Home Care Commission. And I don't believe, I think we all agree that that's not the intent of that language. Department of Human Services should continue to provide those criminal background checks for home care workers who are providing services to Medicaid or OPI clients. I think the purpose of that language was to allow the Home Care Commission the option of providing criminal background checks on home care workers who are exclusively available for private pay citizens, and that the registry would then be a resource for citizens of this state who are seeking either short-term or long-term in-home care, that they could access the registry and be assured that whoever they're getting has had that criminal background check. So we'd like to make sure that we're taking a look at that language and not transferring DHS's function of doing the criminal background checks to the Home Care Commission. Otherwise, we would be looking at more staff than six in the Home Care Commission. The other thing that I would draw to your attention is in Section 7, and I think that is on, I didn't do the page numbers here. Yeah, it's on page 10, section 7, and then sub 2, and then sub D and E. Oh, I'm sorry, 2A. It states, under the conditions prescribed by and at the sole discretion of the commission and in collaboration with the department, provide non-employee compensation to home care workers who attend training sessions approved or sponsored by the commission. Part of the collective bargaining agreement that we have now provides home care workers an opportunity to attend training sponsored by the Home Care Commission on paid time. They get paid at the lower of the two rates set by the department to attend those trainings, and that is in our collective bargaining agreement. This language would make it seem that the Home Care Commission had sole discretion around determining whether home care workers could attend trainings on paid time. The other area is, if you drop down to line 13, prescribing and collecting fees for individuals or categories of individuals who attend training sessions sponsored by the commission, and E, prescribe and charge fees to prospective or current home care workers for criminal record checks. In our conversations with each other, it's understood that what that language would pertain to are home care workers who are exclusively private pay, and that's not what this language says. So it would put in statute a condition that is normally part of the collective bargaining process. So we have no problem with collecting fees from individuals who go to trainings, not home care workers, but we don't want to charge home care workers to go to trainings that they have collectively bargained to attend. And the same is true with the criminal records checks. Currently, Medicaid and OPI home care workers do not pay a fee to get their criminal background checks completed, and we wouldn't want to start charging them for that. So with that, I would be open to any questions that anyone has, and thank you so much for your time.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
How much does a criminal background check cost, and do teachers have to pay for their own criminal background check?
I don't know the answer.
What's the check cost?
If you're going to, you have to come up and identify yourself and speak into the microphone, please.
My name is Debbie Bowers, and I work for Senior and People with Disabilities. I'm the Government Relations Liaison. Chair Morissette, Senator Morissette, and committee members, the question was the cost to the department or how much a criminal history check costs?
Yes. How much would it cost if the home care worker had to pay it themselves, and how much? And is there a difference in the price that DHS pays if they... Do they have a contract?
The difference would be if there's a lot of criteria as to what type of criminal record check you would have to have. If it's a fingerprint-based criminal history check, it could be up to $58 if you went through the state police. If it was just an Oregon criminal history check, it could be anywhere from $12 to $25. It just depends on the extent of what the state police has to do. The department does not charge for the criminal history checks.
12,000 people times 58. Yeah.
And we don't do fingerprint checks on everybody. It depends on the criteria according to the statute.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. James, do you have a response to the concerns about the language in the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, we've met several times. I think we're pretty close, and I think by the time of the work session, we should be able to walk in with some common amendments that we can all agree to. We will have to consult with the governor's office whether the governor wants to continue the role of appointing the executive director. This bill was introduced at the governor's request, so we would really need to check back. Personally, I don't think the department has any opinion or opposition to that, but we would have to confirm that the governor's office wants to be involved, continue to be involved in that role, and we'll consult with them in the interim before we come back.
The other thing that I suddenly realized that I'm lacking is a better understanding of the commission. And so I remember when we passed it, I know some things about it, but is there something that you could get us that would give kind of an overview of the commission and so on?
Yes.
In addition to what we have,
absolutely,
which is simply the bill, I mean, just so we have that information.
Yes, we can get that to you, Chair Morrison.
Okay, good. Thank you. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and that's kind of one of the places I wanted to go. I'm assuming the makeup of the commission is not constitutional.
Yes,
it is. It is constitutional.
Yes.
I find that interesting. Of all the commissions we have, the ones that, I mean, I find it interesting that there's no public members and that the majority of it are recipients of the program, and that's a concern to me. But if that's constitutional, we can't change that. But that gets us potentially into a PERS situation where most of the members of that board were recipients and they misallocated funds. So... just a warning for the future and something that may need to be considered.
Well, I guess maybe a valid concern. I want to know what the duties of the commission are.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Cruz, the commission doesn't run the program. The department runs the program.
But the commission does collective bargaining.
With one exception. And again, this is a very unique relationship. The commission... does the collective bargaining, but DAS represents the commission in the collective bargaining. So really DAS leads the negotiations on behalf of the Home Care Commission. And I think historically with the governor appointing the executive director, DAS leading the negotiations, I think the state's interests are very much at the table, and it's not simply consumers on themselves, but the commission still has a vital role. They're at the table. They're part of all the discussions. So it is a unique relationship, but it does have checks and balances, I think.
Okay. Well, kind of follow up.
Yes.
Slightly off topic, and just something I tried to deal with without resolution about a year ago, had an individual from Ohio who had a mother in Roseburg, and she hired somebody to come in and take care of her, and, you know, private pay sort of thing, and she hired her on a personal services contract, and the employment department said, you can't do that, and so she was stuck with all sorts of unemployment taxes on the back end of all this when it was clearly a personal services contract. Is that a sort of issue that you folks deal with? Because I thought it was absurd that she couldn't hire somebody, but the employment department said that no, that can't be done. I think that's an interesting dilemma.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, I think for the home care workers that are part of this program, we've resolved that. They are employees of the clients represented by the Home Care Commission, and we pay unemployment insurance and workers' comp and all of that in a private pay arrangement. I mean, that could get pretty tricky, and I would agree if it's a contract that you get into a whole different area of law. And I think increasingly we want to provide advice to people that enter private pay arrangements. And I think part of the Home Care Commission's role is to see itself as providing training and advice around that area, even though technically they don't control it.
Well, Ms. Chair, I think the Employment Department looked at what we created and said this is the way it has to be handled, and I think it's removing some flexibility for some people who want to go a different way, and I think at some point that's something that you folks may need to look at and have conversations with the Employment Department, because, you know, if somebody wanted to hire somebody on a personal services contract to take care of their mother, I don't think they should be prohibited from doing that, so...
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Senator George.
I remember when the union brought this initiative forward, I thought to myself, this is probably another one of those very poorly drafted initiatives. And I think we're getting to see that now. But what really bothers me, and back to your comment, is that whenever you grant somebody absolute power, you have an invitation for absolute abuse. Just before I walked into this room, I was outside with one of my constituents whose dad, not by any of the care people we're talking about here, but very similar. He was in a care home, and that man died at the hands of a practitioner. And yet when I read this bill right here, this amendment, it has all of these records being destroyed, and you can't get access to this, you can't get access to that. For criminal prosecution of somebody who may be a danger to one of our constituents, again, I'm really distressed by this. I think it's imperative that at least this section be remain with Department of Health and Human Services, and also there be a retention of records. I can tell you, when I go down to purchase a gun, the state police keeps a record of that, and they're supposed to keep it, I believe, for 5 years and destroy it, but they don't. Now, that seems pretty ridiculous, because what is the chances I'm going to go out and shoot somebody with a gun? Oh, zero. Well, what's the chances that a person might abuse their position with an elderly person they're caring for? Could be pretty high. It happens all the time. And so I really think we need to look at this bill, because this is granting absolute power like nothing I've ever seen. And to a certain extent, we do have to negotiate with the lottery department when we're dealing with them. Would any of you guys like to respond to that? I mean, what's your opinion about this? These records being destroyed, and they're not under anybody's control but this commission?
Now, let me just ask the question of clarification. Many of the boards and commissions are established to oversee people in the various industries. The Board of Nursing, for instance, they have a complaint procedure. They have investigators. They do have records. They do have to report. The Board of... a number of board contractors board, for instance. What about this particular commission? Do you receive complaints from
consumers
about the kind of care and possible abuse? And do you have investigators to look at those complaints?
Chair Morissette, we have public testimony during our, and committee members, we have public testimony during our commission meetings where any person in the public could come with any concern or complaint.
Well,
but if there are complaints about abuse mm-hmm. or something like that, that is usually handled at the local office. They would be referred back, because the Department of Human Services has adult protective services that will go out and handle all of those types of investigations.
Okay.
If I could just add something to that as well, Chair Morissette, Senator George, SPD rules require that home care workers have a criminal background check done every 2 years, or more often if it comes to the attention of the department that a home care worker has engaged in some kind of activity that could create a threat to the physical or emotional or physical mm-hmm. health of the client. So I think the department actually does a very good job of screening out for those types of potential neglect or abuse. I don't know about, this is out of the state police department, how they keep records, but they go back 7 years,
Go ahead.
Yeah, I have a follow-up question. I mean, first of all, I start off by reading the cover sheet, What Does a Major Does? And what I read is, you're exempt from everything. Are you exempt from open meeting law?
No, sir.
You're not exempt from
that. No,
that's good.
Not.
But my understanding about, if I'm reading this correctly, all of these powers of investigation and everything will rest with the commission, not with...
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, if I can clarify, because the section of statute that we're referring to is part of existing Oregon law that has to do with criminal record checks. The Department of Human Services conducts criminal record checks on all home care workers that serve any clients of the department. I think the intent here, and it doesn't read very well, and I think as Ms. Spence said, it needs to be amended. The intent of the Home Care Commission was to be able to assure that criminal record checks could be run against private pay individuals that a family member might want to hire on their own, not going through the department. They're not a client of the department. We're not paying for the care. But currently, there's no legal authorization where anybody could conduct a criminal record check. And the intent here was that the Home Care Commission, since it will have a registry of home care workers, that if a member of the public wants to get such a worker for a private pay basis, we wouldn't have the authority to run the check. So they wanted to insert themselves as having the authority to run that check. But again, all the other standards about the checks and the crimes and the record keeping and all that is part of existing state law now. It's not something new that we're trying to insert in this bill.
If I could clarify that on page 3, line 5. It says that you may not keep any record of fingerprints. And that's the current law.
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, correct. That is current law.
Okay. Are the healthcare workers licensed?
They're not licensed, but they receive a provider enrollment number from the Department of Human Services.
Okay.
And that's after they have completed an application and a criminal record check.
Okay. So the difference between this and, say, the Board of Nursing, which deals with licensed individuals, this is not a licensed individual. So
there's a
different accountability. I was thinking is if this were similar to that, then there could be a formal... Okay, is there a formal complaint procedure? Now, I think you mentioned something about a formal complaint procedure.
Yes, there is.
Tell me about the formal complaint.
In administrative rule, mm-hmm. with senior and people with disabilities, there's a termination process. Home care workers consumers can hire and fire their own home care workers at any time for any reason.
Okay, I understand.
At all.
Okay.
However, if there are other allegations, let's say an APS investigation, Adult Protective Services investigation, then the Department of Human Services, SPD, can actually go through a formal termination process where the home care worker is sent a form letting them know what the allegations are. They have a right to appeal that decision, and they can go all the way up to an ALJ, administrative law judge hearing.
Okay. Yes. Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome. I have a little bit of a different type of concern, if you'll bear me out here. You know, you've done a wonderful thing here. You have moved a culture from people hiring a home caregiver in the Safeway line to having people that are checked and are paid a fair amount of money for their services. There's nothing more personal than having people in your home mm-hmm. caring for you, and particularly if you're fragile mm-hmm. or physically limited. Or any of those things. I commend you for what you have done in this industry. Now, having said that, mm-hmm. I want to tell you that the worst thing that I think you could do would be in the Department of Human Services. The Department of Human Services, for me as an elected official, is just a monster. It's big. I can't get my arms around it. I try to get things done. I try to go through the pecking order. It is the most miserable experience of my political life. And so I'm looking at this wonderful program that I totally respect and applaud, and I wonder, what in the world do you want to make that decision for? So maybe you can convince me.
Well, thank you, Senator Berger. Thank you for the compliment. One of the things that I realized, and I started out working in Multnomah County, and I worked in the local office down there as a home care worker coordinator. And the reason I start there is while I was there, I developed relationships with organizers that worked with SEIU. And I also had to develop relationships with senior and people with disability staff, because on both sides I needed information. I needed to find out how to work through something with SEIU and maybe I could get an issue resolved. I had to find out, you know, what was going on with administrative rules and was I applying this correctly with SPD. The client employee provider program, which most of the consumers that receive services are administered through the Department of Human Services, Senior and People with Disabilities. I see myself in a very close relationship with all of these individuals, and we've had to work together, not always agreeing with each other on everything, but we have to come together as a team to carry this program forth. If we do not work as a team to do that, this program will not be successful. And it has been successful because we have been able to work as a team. Some of the things that I mentioned earlier in my testimony, like the work group that we developed with SPD, that was because we spent hours in a registry user group committee with local office staff, with home care workers, with consumers, with SPD central office staff, with managers from the field. And we began to see things like what we were doing differently and what we were doing the same. And as a result of that, we came together and developed standard procedures that will be carried out statewide. And I think that would not have happened if we were not all connected. I know it seems like a monster out there, but we have to work together to administrate this program. And I think that's why earlier I had said that it was really critical, really important, that if Senate Bill 157 does pass and we are part of DHS, that we continue to have that autonomy to step out and make decisions based on what the Home Care Commission thinks, what the commissioners are saying, what the consumer is saying, and be able to say that. And I think that we've taken that stance already and have still been able to work cooperatively together.
Okay, I have to say something in response, Senator Berger. Mm-hmm. I have worked with James Tace for 3 or 4 or 5 years. I am a member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Disabled. I think he's done an outstanding job in fighting some of the bureaucracy from below and from above. Mm-hmm. And I have absolutely no doubt that he will do an outstanding job in coordinating your program. Mm-hmm. So I just want to
thank you. I agree.
Say that as a balance. So good job, James.
Did I answer your question, Senator?
Well, you did, and I'm happy for you to have that position, and I'm glad you feel that way, because that's part of your job to make that work and move forward. And I don't want you for 1 minute to think that I don't think the best of this particular effort, because I've watched it over the years, and I think it's just great where you are right now. I just have to tell you, in all honesty, the agency that I receive the most complaints from my constituents is the Department of Human Services. And I think it is not the people that work there. They are doing everything that they are supposed to do. I believe it's the size of it. Mm-hmm. It is just so big. And I just think we don't want to lose you and let you get lost in this whole maze of the Department of Human Services. And I noticed one of the quotes that I wrote down that you said, we should be independent of the Department of Human Services. And I thought, right on. I just think that there's a chance here. And I remember, Mr. Chairman, one of the original caucus members of Senior and Disability. So, I mean, I'm a cheerleader behind the efforts in senior and disabilities, and happy to be so. Mm-hmm. But I do get concerned when I see the kind of progress that your program has made for the people that did not have health insurance. I can remember years ago interviewing a group of people that were taking care of people's loved ones all day. They had no health insurance themselves. The only one insured in the family would be their child. So you've come a long way, and I'm not sure what I think about your decision to be blended in this way.
Yes, James.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, and I just want to reemphasize, it was the department's position that the commission should be fully independent and completely have its own staff and operations independent of the department. So we truly support that. The dilemma was, again, the constitutional language that no commission can be a state employee. And literally, as all the lawyers, and believe me, we've been in more rooms with more lawyers than you can shake a stick at, have said that pushes them off into a different kind of animal, like OHSU or like SAFE, and they will have to have their own budget, their own attorneys, their own accountants, their own. So then, as we started looking what it would take as a budget to put that together, that's where we stepped back to this compromise. But I think in the language of the bill and in a proposed interagency agreement, and we've vetted this up and down through the department, we would absolutely say that the staff of the department devoted to this commission are fully independent in carrying out the mission of the commission as required by the Constitution and the statute. So I recognize it's an interesting blend, to say the least, but we actually tried to get to the point where I think you would have us be, and for the legal and technical reasons had to step back just short of that, and we're still trying to accomplish the goal. So,
well, and I also get most of my complaints from the individuals who are dealing with the department, but you have to consider the individuals and their role. Services to children and families is number one, and so you're dealing with parents who've lost their children or about to, or disputing, and there are just all kinds of personal things going on there, and it's a very difficult situation for the caseworkers and so on. And but when I start at the top and work down, I'm able to cut through a lot of the red tape, and I can get back to the constituents or have the department get back and solve some problems. But for a citizen on their own to try to get through, it's daunting for a citizen who has a complaint and doesn't contact a legislator who cuts through that red tape, which raises the question of the role of the ombudsperson, which we're trying to strengthen also, is to give that ombudsperson, in whatever realm they deal in, the authority to get the answers from the director. And I have a bill that would clarify that, but I know it's a difficult thing. Senator Cruz.
You got a bill on just about everything.
No, only the things that are necessary, actually.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I was going back in my memory banks last session when we had a report of an alarming rate of workers' comp claims with your group. Has that been addressed?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, we've worked very closely both with the commission and with SEIU. That really has leveled off. The rates that I think some of us were panicking about have been mitigated to some extent. But we're still working at it because, again, this is not a typical work site where you go to work, you have a supervisor on site. This is a very sort of decentralized industry, so we're having to pay very careful attention. And the other thing is many of the homes of the clients themselves are not necessarily the safest environment that you would want from a workers' comp kind of perspective. So it is an interesting arrangement, but I think we're working hard at it, and I think we've made a lot of progress and have more work to do.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator George.
I feel vindicated because with that many attorneys working on it, no wonder I couldn't understand what you guys were trying to do. So I'm going to have somebody do it, if I could, Mr. Chairman, draw me a graph showing me who's doing what. Because right now it does look jumbled. Thank you, guys.
Good. Thank you very much. Mike, would you come up, please? Or, oh, you're all set up.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, Mike.
Yeah. For the record, my name is Mike Volpe, and I come to you in support of one of Senate Bill 157 with its amendments. And I come to you as a commissioner, as a service receiver for approximately 12 or 13 years. As a commissioner, I see the workings of the commission, I think, is going in a very positive manner, as has been related by the several people that have spoken previously, and I would like to see that continue. And one thing that has been somewhat of an impediment has been when the commission needs to do certain things, it can be rather difficult just because of the way things are organized right now, and trying to access necessary funds can be rather difficult. And I will rely upon the expertise of the people that have spoken before me to know a little bit more about this, and that's why I support this. But I want to see the commission work as smoothly as possible. I also wanted to speak to you as a receiver of services for 12 or 13 years. The people that do this kind of work, they do a lot of very complex work. I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for the people that have been working with me for 13 years. And I have some pretty complex health needs, as you might be able to ascertain just by looking at me. I have no movement below my neck, and due to multiple sclerosis. So, I mean, the people that work with me do a lot of very complex work. And so I just wanted to say that these people deserve everything that, you know, I mean, they deserve the benefits that they're receiving now. And I'm very happy to see that they do have health insurance for the first time, and that they do have a higher salary. And it's been commented to me several times by the people that work with me as the home care workers that they enjoy, that they like the, for the first time ever, having days off work and pay for vacation pay, just like regular employees. And another benefit of the Home Care Commission, which I don't think has been mentioned yet, but now for the first time ever, they actually have their state and federal taxes withheld so that they do not have to figure out how much they need the kids to separate from each and every check so that they can pay their taxes at the end of the fiscal year. That is a big change that happened, and it's been a benefit to the home care workers. Thank you very much, and I'm very happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Mike, thank you, Mike. How long have you been, okay, you've had care for the last?
That's 13 years, about 8 months.
And so the difference in the care that you've received since the formation of the commission and before?
Some of the things that they have mentioned before. It's hard for me to say exactly, but I do believe that the tenure, the people, I mean, I would say that I have probably about, currently it's, I'm guessing about 100% turnover per year, which means I'm doing, you know, one person per year for, you know, everybody every year. But in the past, it was more than that. Okay. Exactly what it would be very difficult because I have a number of people working with me so that I do have backup in case somebody is ill. So it's hard to determine. And
well, the reliability of staff and help is significant.
It's significant. And I do believe that people have been more reliable. I know that they have commented very favorably about some of the changes that have taken place. So for the dedication of the home care workers, even before these benefits were in place, is just remarkable. But I would say that the satisfaction of the home care workers with these benefits is higher. I can say that because they have remarked that they enjoy the slightly higher pay and the benefits, and especially the health insurance.
Thank you, Mike. Okay, thank you. Okay, Kirkbride. Scott Lay, would you come up, please?
Senator Morissette and fellow senators, I'm Kay Kirkbride, and I'm, because Scott Lay, the chair of our Home Care Commission, is ill today, I have been asked to present his testimony, and I count it a privilege to do that. I'm a member of the Home Care Commission, and my position on the Home Care Commission is representing the Governor's Commission on Senior Services. So I'm going to read, with your permission, Scott Lay's testimony.
Okay.
I am here in support of the Oregon Home Care Commission and Senate Bill 157 with amendments. I am the current chairperson of the Home Care Commission and a consumer of in-home services. From these perspectives, I have a clear view of the benefits offered by the Home Care Commission, both now and in the future. Senate Bill 157 with amendments will allow the Home Care Commission to comply with its mandate more efficiently and more easily. As the chairperson, I have become aware of the various issues that make it difficult for the Commission, its executive director, and her staff to complete the necessary activities of the Home Care Commission. Because of the way the original ballot initiative and the related constitutional amendment were written, the Oregon Home Care Commission is existing in a form somewhere between a true state agency and an independent entity. The Home Care Commission is unable to function as easily and effectively as it would if it were a true state agency. Because of the way the constitutional amendment was written, the Home Care Commission, and more especially the executive director, must perform many tasks that do not follow normal operating procedures for a state agency. Senate Bill 157 with amendments will allow the Home Care Commission to perform its mandates and other activities in a much more straightforward manner. It will let the executive director provide the specifics on how our present structure causes difficulty. I will say, however, that I have had several discussions with both the previous executive director of the Home Care Commission and with our present executive director about these issues. It is very clear that our present status in the state system causes significant difficulties and barriers for the Home Care Commission staff to overcome when trying to carry out the activities of the Commission. I can speak for all of the commissioners when I say that we believe that Senate Bill 157 with amendments will greatly reduce these difficulties. As a consumer of in-home services, I am well aware of the difficulties faced by seniors and persons with disabilities who use in-home assistance. Because of the efforts of the Home Care Commission and its staff, finding and managing in-home service providers or home care workers will become much easier for a senior or a person with significant disability to locate qualified, trained applicants. Once the applicants have been identified, the process of interviewing, hiring, and managing employees will hopefully be less stressful and more productive. As it now stands, this process is very time-consuming and frustrating. The Home Care Commission offers trainings on various issues relevant to the providers of in-home services. Home care workers can avail themselves of trainings such as working with challenging behaviors, keeping it professional, working together, diabetes by the number, dementia and Alzheimer's, helping caregivers fight fraud and abuse, preventing disease transmission, protecting against sprains and strains, and taking responsibility in personal safety, and also a training on grief and loss. The Home Care Commission has partnered with the State Independent Living Council and the SEIU to develop and provide a very unique and beneficial training program to consumers, which are the employers of in-home services. This training will help individuals become more comfortable with their role as employers. The registry and the referral system and the training program empowers the consumer by offering resources and backup so that they are less likely to feel alone and overwhelmed. The training program for home care workers helps them to provide better services in a more professional manner. By supporting Senate Bill 157 with amendments, you will be helping the Home Care Commission and its staff continue to perform its mandate without undue difficulties. And the testimony is signed, thank you, Scott Lay, Chairperson of the Home Care Commission. Thank you.
Now, you do deal with fraud and abuse. In other words, people that hire home health care workers can rely on them to intervene and help on certain situations. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and they have a training. The training is by the Medicare patrol people.
Okay.
On learning about preventing fraud and abuse of the systems.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Bill. Yeah. Oh, Senator Berger.
Thank you very much. Are you a member of the commission?
I am.
Mm-hmm. Would it be possible for you to get me a list of the members of the commission, and perhaps other members of the committee might be interested in seeing exactly who are members?
Yes, we will do that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just get the list to our administrator, and we will get some other information on the commission, just kind of background overview so we have a better understanding. So, good.
Thank you, Senators.
And with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5157, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 191. We have a list. Okay. Joel, would you come up, please? Is there someone you would like to bring with you?
I will.
Okay. Bring your crew. Okay. All right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Ario. I'm the insurance administrator with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me is Julia Huddleston from the Department of Human Services, and I'll testify to the general purposes of this bill, and then she'll augment my testimony, particularly related to the DHS role and the long-term care partnership issue. Start with a couple brief comments on the importance of long-term care insurance, both to consumers and to the state of Oregon. It is a vital product for consumers because many of us, particularly as we live longer lives, end up needing nursing home care and other types of long-term care in our later years. And for many people, that ends up bankrupting them, and they end up in the Medicaid program. And the idea of long-term care insurance is to think ahead, buy this kind of policy. Typically, it's marketed to people in their 40s and 50s, although the average age of people purchase it today is still older than that. But the idea is if it's marketed to younger people, it's much more affordable at that age, and it can provide an important financial cushion later in life. So it's a very important product for the consumer, and this bill makes it a better product for consumers. It's also very important to the state of Oregon, and Julia will testify more to this, so I'll be very brief here, in that when people cannot afford their own long-term care, they often do end up in the state Medicaid program. As we all know, Medicaid is a major driver of the state budget today, and within Medicare, nursing home care and other forms of institutional care are a major driver. So this is a very important issue to the state of Oregon, and if we can do more to have people insure themselves and be self-reliant, it will be better for the state budget as well. That's the reason why this is an important issue. In terms of what this bill does specifically, Senate Bill 191 has three basic sections. The first section improves consumer protections on this product, and those protections are listed on page 2 of my testimony and in the fact sheet that you have in front of you, but it restricts pre-existing health condition exclusions. It makes it easier for people to continue their policies if they can't afford premiums in the future. It makes it easier for people when they have to, it makes it harder for an insurer to rescind a policy and provides a number of additional consumer protections like that, all of which make the product more attractive and a better bargain for the consumer. The second thing the bill does is increases continuing education requirements for insurance producers or insurance agents who sell the product. The bill would require someone who's going to be involved in selling long-term care and the partnership as we go forward to have at least 8 hours of initial training in long-term care, and the bill enumerates a number of different areas in which that long-term care education should take place. And then, secondly, requires an ongoing 4 hours in every two-year period thereafter of training in this, in the long-term care product. That is a part of the overall responsibility. It would be included in what insurance agents are today required to do, which is 24 hours of continuing education each two-year period. So somebody who is selling long-term care in the first initial phase would have a third of that time taken up with long-term care, and then on an ongoing basis, one-sixth of the time, 4 hours out of 24. The third thing the bill does is allows the state of Oregon to join the partnership. And the idea of the partnership, and then I'll turn it over to Julie to discuss the details here, is that the bargain is if you join, if you purchase long-term care earlier in your life and do end up exhausting the benefit, then the partnership program will reward you for that by not forcing you to spend down as much as you would otherwise have to spend down to be eligible for Medicaid. So the bargain from the state side is if you're willing to take responsibility for yourself earlier in life, then we will reward that if it turns out that you exhaust your benefits. So in that sense, we hope it to be a win-win for the consumer and for the state of Oregon. With that brief overview of the product, I'd be happy to answer questions, and you may want to hear from Julie first and then take questions from both of us.
Okay. Chair Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Julia Huddleston, and I work in the Senior and People with Disabilities Division of the Department of Human Resources. And over the past year, 18 months, I've been privileged enough to work on the long-range planning effort for the future of long-term care that the governor directed the department to undertake. Oregon's getting older, as we all know. Today, about one in every eight Oregonians is over 65. By 2025, which is only 18 years from now, one of every five Oregonians will be over 65. The scarier number a little bit is how many Oregonians are over the age of 85. Today, about 65,000 Oregonians are over 85. That number is projected to be more than 90,000 by the year 2025. And people's need for long-term care increases as they age. Most 65-year-olds are healthy and in good shape and don't need long-term care. But for those folks who are 85-plus, some national studies have estimated that 4 out of every 10 need long-term care. You live to 90, the odds are 6 out of 10 that you'll need long-term care. And it just continues to accelerate. And long-term care is very expensive. In 2005, nursing facility care in the state, in the city of Eugene cost about $60,000 a year. Now, we all know nursing facility care is expensive, but 4 hours a day of care from a private care provider cost about $18,700 a year. So care gets extraordinarily expensive, and most people don't know who pays for long-term care. A lot of folks think somehow that Medicare will pay for long-term care, which it will, only in nursing facilities under very limited circumstances for a very limited time. Most people don't realize that Medicare doesn't pay for community-based care. Medicare pays for home care, again, only under very limited circumstances. So what Senate Bill 191 does is gives Oregon the direction to
to file the application with the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to participate in the Long-Term Care Insurance Partnership Program. These programs were established originally in the early 1990s in four states, Connecticut, California, New York, and Indiana. And what these programs do in their simplest form is what Mr. Arroyo said. They say to a consumer, if you pre-plan, if you purchase long-term care insurance, then even if you use up your maximum benefit in long-term care insurance, we will discount that amount when you apply for Medicaid eligibility, and we will not recover that amount after your death when Medicaid recovers from your estate. The maximum benefit in the federal legislation is passed, which was first effective in 2007, is $250,000. So if a consumer buys a policy, a long-term care policy, that provides up to $250,000 of benefits, and today in the state of Oregon, that would pay for about 4 years of nursing facility care, which is far more than most people use. If a consumer buys that and accesses Medicaid, then Medicaid will, in essence, say, okay, at your death, that $250,000 out of your estate, we didn't have to pay it, so we're not going to come and recover it from your estate. So it incentivizes the purchase of long-term care insurance. In the four states that have participated, admittedly 15, 17 years is not a long time in the insurance business at all. But in the four states that participated, fewer than 5% of the people who've actually had to access the policies to date have fallen on through to a Medicaid level of benefit. So fewer than 5%. This bill directs us to file the state plan amendment. We would go into, of course, rulemaking behind that to make rules to ensure the consumer protections. We're looking for opportunities to engage with federal partners in training and technical assistance, ways to help people understand the benefits of this, and to achieve the volume in sales that will make the product more affordable for all of us. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I don't see the four states listed on your testimony.
I'm sorry, Chair Morris, that they're not, but they're New York, California, Indiana, and Connecticut.
Okay. Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question. Someone told me that by the time you qualify for the use of your long-term care insurance, that you actually are so ill that you don't use it very much, and that it's an utter waste of money for a private pay. Would you disagree with that?
Chair Morissette, Senator.
That's all right. I like to be elevated.
And I'll ask Joel to comment, too. I've not heard that before. What I will tell you is that many of them are based on limitations in activities of daily living, and I believe generally they're based on limitations in two or three activities of daily living. Those are the same limitations that we have for Medicaid benefits as well.
Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, Julia is correct. It does take a fair amount of limitation on your daily activities to qualify for the product, but as Julia suggested earlier, as our population ages, more and more people get into that category. So they do end up accessing the benefit. Most people don't access the benefit for long periods of time, so a $250,000 policy might be more than most people would want to purchase. That's the upper end of what you could qualify with, and people may well purchase lesser policies. The other thing to say about long-term care is that it is a niche product to a degree, in the sense that you can be either too poor or too rich to make for it to be sensible for you to buy it. If you don't have the assets anyway that you're trying to protect, if you're going to be on the Medicaid program anyway, if you hit an expense of $30,000 or $40,000 or $50,000, it does not make sense to buy the product for that person. And by the same token, this is not an unlimited liability that's covered here. So if you're very well off and can afford to pay $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year if you have to, then it doesn't make sense for you to buy this product either in general. Now, you may have some insurance agents tell you that it's a better way to finance and so forth, and there may be certain circumstances in which that's true. But in general, you're looking at people who would look at a $60,000 or $70,000 expense for a couple years in there, most of the time for a few years, and say that that's something that they'd rather prepay now through insurance than have to deal with directly out of their estates at an elderly age.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I'd like to make a point, yes. Anyway. When you talk about $18 an hour, that is correct. But in the case of my parents, I so wanted to keep them in my home as long as possible. But it came to be that, well, I would just take the 8 o'clock at night to 8 o'clock in the morning shift. Mm-hmm. But it came to be that I truly needed someone there 24 hours a day. And I wanted to have an agency that was certified, and I couldn't find someone that would, it was $18 an hour, and I want you to know that $18 an hour times 24 hours that comes out to $13,223 a month, $158,000 a year. Uh-huh. So we came to a financial problem that it was much better to put them in a very nearby, very nice, wonderful foster care home. But still, it's huge expense. So I wanted to get that clarified because, $18,700 annual cost doesn't sound too much, but usually if they need care, they need more than... when they truly need 24-hour care in a nursing home, it's very expensive.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monis Anderson, that raises another issue that's important in terms of the consumer evolution of this product. It used to be a product that primarily only paid if you went into a nursing home. And one of the consumer protections that you see listed here is that there's actually a prohibition on that now in the policies. It has to be a more flexible kind of benefit that does allow you to access the benefit for the wide variety of conditions that you may face in the future. And that's been an important evolution in the long-term care product is to make it more flexible in terms of when you can use the benefit.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Rob Johnson. John Morgan. Elise Brown, would you please come up? Rob, you have to travel 100 miles back home.
Oh, I may have marked the wrong box there.
Oh, well then, forget it. Go ahead. Who wants to go first?
Go ahead, Rob.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Johnson, and I'm a government affairs representative with the Oregon Healthcare Association. We represent just over 550 long-term care facilities in Oregon, ranging from in-home care agencies to assisted living and residential care facilities, as well as nursing facilities. I'm going to try to keep my comments brief today, but I wanted to come in support of Senate Bill 191 for several reasons. As you all know, Oregon's long-term care system is heavily dependent on Medicaid funds to be able to provide high-quality care to low-income seniors in the care setting that is most appropriate for their needs. The Long-Term Care Insurance Partnership Program has the potential to greatly lessen the burden on the state coffers for those funds. Rather than deferring to a dependence on Medicaid in their twilight years, Senate Bill 191 encourages individuals to plan for their future by purchasing long-term care insurance. Their care would then be paid for by insurance benefits rather than Medicaid dollars, which in the end would free up those dollars for other programs. As you've all heard, the program was piloted in four states to begin with in the early 90s. And just to give you a concrete example of how it can save Medicaid dollars, I can cite one example from California. They took a sample of 18 individuals who purchased qualified long-term care insurance plans, received the benefits from the insurance plans, exhausted the benefits, and then accessed Medicaid. And found that had those individuals spent down their personal assets and then qualified for Medicaid, it would have cost the state of California approximately $1.3 million more dollars in Medicaid to serve those clients. So it does save a lot of money, and I think it can do great things in Oregon as well. The other thing about Senate Bill 191 is it allows for choice in long-term care setting, which is kind of a hallmark of Oregon's long-term care system, because the qualified insurance plans would cover a range of services from in-home care all the way through nursing care. I think that we can also all support legislation that encourages people to plan for their futures, especially given the data and statistics that we've all seen recently about the baby boomers and the dramatic increase in Oregon's senior population over the next 20 years. I've had a chance to talk with several stakeholders about the bill. I've reviewed the amendments, and I can say that the long-term care industry is definitely supportive of Senate Bill 191, and we would urge you to pass it. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and I would be more than happy to answer any questions.
Elise? I'll move the tissues here. Elise Brown, representing America's Health Insurance Plans, which has over 1,300 members across the country insuring 200 million Americans. And like Rob and others that have gone before me, we too, AHIP, has participated in the work group. We're very supportive of this bill and have been working on legislation like this across the country. And Rob just said it best for two reasons. It offers consumers more choice, and it saves the state money. It saves the federal government money. So for those reasons, AHIP stands in support of this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair.
And we have a question. Aha! Yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Thought you could sneak through that one, right?
Really?
Do you support the dash one?
I'm looking at the dash one, and that's what I support.
Okay. Just on the record. So.
It's actually the dash two. The dash ones were exactly the same.
Okay, dash two. I
confuse
ones and twos.
I just want to make sure.
I'm looking at the dash one, but the date has been changed. Right. So we are supportive of dash one, dash two. Then.
Okay. My mistake. Sorry.
No, it's okay.
That would make them dash 12 if we had.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Mangan. I'm Regional Vice President for the American Council of Life Insurers, who write actually the majority of long-term care insurance in the United States and in Oregon. And just echoing the other speakers, we're strongly in support of the partnership program and commend Oregon for moving in this direction. We support the bill and the Dash 2 amendments, and I would just note that a couple of benefits that Joel mentioned in the bill are the training requirements, which improve the ability of producers, hopefully, to help consumers make the right choice, because these are complex choices, but also provide uniformity from state to state as it affects consumers. So some of the provisions in this bill will make it easier for consumers who, for instance, may retire and move to a different state or have retired from other states and moved to Oregon, so that they are receiving a uniform treatment under their long-term care plan. So for those reasons, we strongly urge your support of the bill.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair, I'd suggest that we move the bill before somebody comes in and opposes it.
Is there anybody out there in opposition? Okay. Thank you very much. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 191 and entertain, we'll open a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 191.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 191. Any comments? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 191 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves 191 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Comments?
Yes.
It does say that. I'm just wondering if there's a fiscal. It says here in the amendment that you're talking about continuing education courses. I mean, you're not going to need money or anything.
Modest class size still when you see that.
We don't like that word.
Because we don't have a fiscal, and I sort of hate to.
No. But you couldn't help raising the question, though, right?
Well, in my committee, I don't pass one out until I get a fiscal analysis.
Well, we're out.
Well, in my committee, we try to avoid that.
Yeah.
We asked the president to rescind.
We did.
Okay, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Monica Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator George?
Excuse.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Morrison?
Aye. Senate Bill 191 has passed. What?
That was a vote to accept the amendment.
No, we did.
Pardon me? We did the amendment.
No, we did. Yeah. I would be very happy to carry the bill, but if any of you would like to carry it, that would be fine also.
Senator, I think you'd do a wonderful job.
I will carry the bill. Thank you. I just wanted to give you an opportunity. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.